Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I am Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor in the history department at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I'm your host for this interview. And for this episode, I'm speaking with Stephen Beda. Dr. Beda is an associate professor of history at the University of Oregon in beautiful Eugene, Oregon, and is the author of Strong Winds and Widowmakers, Workers, Nature, and Environmental Conflict in Pacific Northwest Timber Country, which came out with the University of Illinois Press last year in 2023. Welcome to the New Books Network, Steve. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be here.
Why don't we start, as we always do on this show, by just hearing a little bit about who you are. What is your background? And I'm especially interested in how you arrived at history. What got you interested in history?
Yeah. So I'm originally from the suburbs of Chicago, which, you know, I say in my book is both geographically and socioeconomically distant from Pacific Northwest timber country. And, you know, the way I got into history was growing up. My dad was really into history, and you know, he encouraged a healthy, you know, interest in history when I was a kid, but it was never something I considered as a major, and certainly not something I considered as a career. And originally, I went to college at the University of Colorado in Boulder. And I originally started, you know, my academic life as a physics major, which I look back on that now, I'm like, what were you thinking? Because I am not good at math, and I hate math. And physics is a lot of math. And my first semester of college, I had a 1.3 GPA. So if you would have told me at that time that I'd eventually be a professor, I would have laughed at you. But I really needed to move things around. So on a whim, I took a history class about the American Revolution, and it blew my mind. I loved it. I actually studied because I was interested in the material, not because I felt like I had to. And then I took another history class and another one, and here we are. So I'll often tell students that story for two reasons. Is, you know, first, make sure you find a major that you're passionate about, because that will make your life a lot easier. And also, even if you fail some classes or really screw up, you can always turn things around. So that's kind of how I got into history, was failed physics major.
Well, and that's a really important lesson for students who, you know, in as much as they look and think to us at all, they think that we must have all been like straight A students who were perfect at school the whole time. But I, too, was a pretty mediocre student for a long time until I found history. So I can relate. And I think it's good that you tell your students that as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, no, and for the exact reasons you say, that, you know, we don't all start off as, you know, very studious, very academic people. It's a journey and it's a process. And you know, what facilitated that process, at least for me, was finding a subject that I really, really cared about, and I wanted to know more. So
right.
That's why I was
right.
Students.
So how then do you get from Chicago to the topic of this book? As you said, that you're very distant in many different ways from this topic that we're writing about here. So what brought you to this topic?
Yeah, so it's not a great story. But so when I was growing up in the suburbs of Chicago, during the summers in high school and then a few summers in college, when I returned home, I worked for a tree trimmer. You know, again, this is the suburbs of Chicago. We are like trimming trees. We are doing, you know, every now and then we'll take out a tree. On the spectrum of, you know, logging, one side being Pacific Northwest logging, this is the farthest, most distant end you can get. It's nowhere near actual logging. Nevertheless, it was a small company. It was three or four people. And every day at the end of, you know, our work day, we would go to, you know, my boss ran the business out of his garage. We would just return to the garage, put away the chainsaws, put away the tools. And on one of the cabinets, he had a postcard that someone had sent him, I think from like the California Redwoods. And it was one of those postcards. It was like made to look, it was an old picture, but it was a new postcard. And it was, I assume, some loggers from the late 19th, early 20th century. And they were essentially laying in the notch of a tree. You know, redwood logging, redwoods are massive. And one of the things that, this happens in Oregon and Washington too, anytime a photographer would come by a work site, a logging work site, they would have to like almost always take a picture of a logger laying in a notched out tree in order to show how big these trees are and, you know, provide a sense of scale. So that picture just always stuck with me. And then when I was in college, you know, one of my professors floated the idea of me writing an honors thesis, and I was all on board for that. And then, you know, once you decide you're going to write an honors thesis, you have to figure out a topic. And I was kind of playing with some ideas for topics. And this, at that time, that image of that postcard just kind of like reemerged in my mind. I'm like, oh, I bet there's a story there about logging and loggers. So I wrote my undergraduate honors thesis about loggers in Washington State. And, you know, then when I applied to graduate school, I felt that there was more I still wanted to say and still more I wanted to explore about the history of logging. So I applied to graduate school proposing to write more about loggers and logging. Got into the University of Washington for graduate school, which is a really, really great place to be if you want to study logging, because it's in Seattle, which, you know, Washington is another really kind of important state in the history of Pacific Northwest timber. And so it was a great place for me to be. I kept exploring the issue more and more. I just never strayed away from my interest in logging. So that's kind of how I got into the subject.
And the central argument that you're making in this book about logging, I mean, it's really about timber workers, right? And,
yes,
and
yes.
Clay, you're arguing here that in this book that timber workers are, you know, they're environmentalists fundamentally. This runs counter to, I think, the usual stereotype that a lot of people have of environmentalists as first and foremost as like activists, right? Or as, you know, people that are not dissimilar from me, office workers who like to go hiking on weekends, right?
Sure.
So can you, and we'll talk a lot about this argument and kind of walk through the history later, but just in kind of like a thumbnail kind of way, can you explain your argument here?
Yeah. So I think what's key to understanding the main argument of the book, which absolutely is that timber workers are environmentalists, is that what you have to understand about people from timber working communities is that the forest has many meanings, values, and uses in their lives. Yes, it is a really important place of work. It is where many of them make their living. But it's also a place where they go for recreation, hiking, backpacking, camping. It is a place that they have long relied on for subsistence, either through forest foraging or hunting or fishing. And so once you understand that they care deeply about these places and these places are really a part of their culture, yes, they want to continue to harvest trees because that's how they earn their paycheck. But they also care about protecting the other uses and values of forests, among them, you know, wildlife habitat and a good functioning ecology. So over the course of their history, timber workers have always been concerned with ways in which they can balance the uses and demands that we all place on forests. And over the course of their history, they have at times advocated for more harvests and more tree cutting. But at really important moments in their history, they've also advocated for, you know, impositions on cutting and new regulations that would limit the amount of harvests in order to protect the multiple ways they know and use the forest. And I might actually go, you know, so right, one of the key arguments of the book is that timber workers are environmentalists. I actually sometimes go a step further and say timber workers are the best environmentalists. And the reason I often say that is, you know, as you said, a lot of the stereotypical environmentalists are people who live in cities, often from the middle class, often white. Now, again, as historians, we all know that that characterization doesn't quite hold up, but that is the common perception. And these folks tend to view nature, and especially places like the Northwest Forest, as primarily recreational spaces. And they often, their activism centers around preserving outdoor spaces for recreation and recreational use. And what I think, and the more I have studied this topic, the more kind of adamant I become in this belief, but simply saying we have to preserve forests for recreational use and or wildlife habitat or, you know, ecosystem functionality, it's too easy. And one of the things I always tell people, and I would encourage everyone listening to us right now, stop for a moment, look around you, and just take stock of how much lumber is around you. Now, if you're listening to this inside of a house, that house is probably framed of lumber. A lot of the furniture you're sitting at, probably made of lumber. I hope some people who listen to this will buy my book. Book is made of paper. Paper was once lumber. Lumber also shows up in some very unexpected places. It's used in paints. Timber products are used in paints. They are used in cosmetics. They are used in medicines. Lumber is a part of modern life, and it is inseparable from modern life. So to simply say we have to preserve all the forests, it doesn't account for all the ways in which our economy and our modern world relies on timber. The much trickier question is, how do we provide timber for construction, for all the other things I said, pharmaceuticals, furniture, and how do we protect wildlife habitats and ecosystems? And because timber workers have, I think, better than most people, recognize the multiple demands that society places on forests, they have often been in a better position to advocate for and pursue, I think, more realistic and more reasonable timber policies that will allow for some harvests and allow for the protection of ecosystems and wildlife habitat.
I mean, when you were saying that, I was looking around my apartment where I'm currently recording this episode from. And yeah, I am encased in timber products all around me right now. So that's a useful exercise for thinking about that.
Oh, I was going to say, and it's, again, I think this is, and again, I'm like most of those environmentalists, right? I'm from the kind of, well, suburban, urban middle class. And, you know, when we live a life where, or we do a job that doesn't require, you know, getting our hands dirty, I'm 90% of my day, I'm sure like you, is sitting at my desk, staring at my computer. You know, when I do projects around the home and I need lumber, I go to the hardware store and I just pull it off the shelf. I don't think about the fact that this was once a tree. You know, same thing with a book, you know, holding a book, and like any historian, right, my shelves are full of books. It's easy not to think about the fact that this was once a tree. But once you start recognizing that, you start realizing that, yes, we need a management system that allows for multiple uses and values of timber.
Well, let's get into the history that you tell here, the story that you tell. So why don't we begin with just kind of, I mean, I bet people have some idea about what the Pacific Northwest is like, but I'm curious if you could kind of describe the environment of this place and when large-scale lumbering began in this region, in this environment. Because by the end of the 19th century, you know, timber companies are already beginning to shape the Northwest environment and changing the nature of timber work, too. So can you explain the kind of beginnings of this story?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the most important things to understand about the Pacific Northwest, or at least the parts of the Pacific Northwest where logging was really important, is that it is, in terms of temperature, it's fairly temperate, and it's also extremely rainy. Now, some, you know, people listening may have not been to the Pacific Northwest. Those from the Pacific Northwest who have visited here know that the actual climate is very, really varied. We have, you know, wet, cool conditions on the west side of the region. It is very dry and arid on the east side of the region. But, you know, the areas of the region where logging has been most important, very temperate, very rainy. And this created ideal conditions for forests. So over the course of centuries, forests grew very dense, very large, which means there was a lot of money to be made by people willing to invest the time, effort, and capital in establishing a timber industry. So the timber industry in Washington, Oregon, Idaho, British Columbia, it doesn't really get off the ground until the early 20th century. There were some local sawmills and small timbering operations during kind of the early era of white settlements, mostly in Oregon, but those were small, mostly seasonal mills. And for the most part, up until about World War I-ish, the timber industry, or the national timber industry, is located in the Midwest, Minnesota, Wisconsin, those areas. But starting in 1900, a lot of timber companies, they start buying up Northwest forest land primarily as a speculative venture. Railroad companies are selling off their land grants relatively cheaply, and you know, timber companies realize that they can buy land, speculate in it, and sell it off at a profit, hopefully sell it off at a profit without really having to do any work. And they believe that they could profit off the timberland through speculation, because over the course of the late 19th, early 20th century, this is kind of the middle of America's Industrial Revolution. There is an insatiable demand for lumber across the American economy. So they say, oh, timber prices are going to rise dramatically, and we'll be able to sell off this land. Well, what happens, you know, best laid plans, what happens is a series of fires in the early 20th century combined with rising insurance rates and one of the many economic depressions that happens in the late 19th century really kind of, you know, disrupts the speculative market. And so timber companies who now owned all this land say, hey, in order to make a profit, we're going to have to cut the timber, and they want to cut it really fast. Because what's key to understanding what happens in the Northwest, both environmentally and in terms of labor as well, is that you got to understand that most of the companies who are owning land and running the timber companies in this region aren't located in this region. They are, you know, companies like the Weyerhaeuser Timber Company that is located in Minnesota, or the Long Bell Timber Company, which comes out of the American South. So it's a lot of Southern companies, Midwestern companies, and they really don't want to be holding land in the, you know, then distant Pacific Northwest. So their goal is to essentially cut as much timber as quickly as possible, get back their investment on this failed speculative venture, and then essentially disinvest from the region. So the result of that is a lot of cutting really, really fast that has long-term economic and environmental consequences. You know, what happens is in the course of a decade and a half, they completely transform the Northwest from, you know, the speculative landscape to a resource colony where there's new railroads, there are new company towns, there are essentially new cities spring up overnight, you know, built for the sole purpose of facilitating getting lumber out of the woods, into the mills, and into the marketplace. So again, in terms of ecological consequences, clear cuts expand across the landscape. You know, smoke billowing out from sawmills. It becomes an industrialized landscape really, really quickly.
So then what was life like for the workers themselves? There's a line in the book that you use in talking about this that I really like. You said, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, but you talk about how human, natural, and industrial worlds, they grew together in the lives of timber workers and in kind of timber work itself. How is that the case in this era, the turn of the century Pacific Northwest?
Yeah. So the important thing to understand, and a lot of what the arguments my book hinge on, is understanding where workers were living, particularly in the early 20th century. So, you know, as I just described, logging is getting off the ground in this really quick, really aggressive fashion. And one of the consequences of this rapid industrial development is that employers need a small army of workers. And at the time, the early 20th century, the Northwest is very, very poorly populated. So they have to, you know, bring out a lot of workers. Yeah, this is true of other industries in America at this time, too. A lot of immigrant workers, a lot of people who are coming from agricultural communities, entering the industrial world. So they bring out a lot of workers. And the immediate problem they face is, well, we need a place for these workers to live. Especially, you know, the more the industry kind of relocated to the hinterlands, they couldn't rely on cities to provide housing for all these workers. So in the timber employers or timber companies, they build an extensive network of company towns. And these are where workers are living. Now, across American industry in the early 20th century, a lot of employers were relying on company towns. It was seen by employers in this era as a way to essentially control workers, to mollify labor radicalism. You know, if workers are living in a house that the company owns, they're going to be less inclined to join a union and engage in some sort of, you know, labor activism, because then they're putting their family's well-being at risk, not simply just their own job. And one of the things that employers do in other industries is they kind of create really lavish company towns with nice homes, recreational facilities, because it was a way of attempting to garner the loyalties of workers. Say, hey, by sticking with me and staying away from unions, you'll have this nice house with this really pleasant area to live in. Company towns in the Pacific Northwest timber industry looked really, really different. They weren't very comfortable places to live. Homes were often thrown together of scrap lumber. And, I already mentioned that it rains a lot in the Pacific Northwest. They were notorious for leaking and for not keeping out the elements. You'd often have a family, crammed together in one small little shack. And the reason employers really didn't invest a whole lot of money in building these more lavish company towns is for the same reasons I already talked about, is they want to get out of the Northwest as quickly as they can. So they don't want to invest a lot of money in a more permanent town. So they essentially throw up these kind of shacks, almost overnight, tell workers, hey, here's your home, enjoy. And they really don't provide workers a whole lot of other, amenities. So in order to survive in this world, timber workers have to look to the forest. So they start hunting, fishing, forest foraging. That is part of how they subsist in this world. Likewise, there are really no recreational facilities, or employers aren't providing recreational facilities. So timber workers are looking at the forest for recreation. So when I say that the industrial, the worlds of industry and labor all combined, that's exactly what I'm talking about, is that the industry had created this living situation where workers weren't provided with much. So workers have to look to, the forest in order to provide for the basic day-to-day needs. And that's kind of crucial to the overall argument, because, one of the things I argue is that by using the forest for subsistence, for recreation, and also for work, this is how they came to develop a kind of multi-use view of the forest and how it came to have multiple, understandings in their lives.
And this work that you're describing, it was pretty dangerous too. That's one of the central themes of this book, is all of the inherent risks of timber work. I mean, for those listening who don't have a copy of the book in front of them like I do, I mean, this book is chock full of really fantastic photographs, and this is going to be the surprise of a century, but a lot of trees in the Pacific Northwest were and are really big. And so actually doing the work with these, giant like mammoth trees, it was quite dangerous is one of the big takeaways of this book for me.
Yeah, it was absolutely dangerous. And again, had I had, one of the challenges we always face in writing a book is, how much to include about one specific subject within the broader book. But I could have written an entire book just filled with anecdotes and stories about horrific, horrendous accidents. Not that I would want to write that book, nor might people want to read it. It hugely, hugely dangerous. And actually, there is a great book all about danger, death, and dying in the timber industry. And I think the title is very illustrative. The book is called More Deadly Than War. It's by Andrew Prouty. It was published in the 80s, still a kind of classic. But again, in some ways, this work could be more deadly than war. So yeah, one of the things that is impacting how dangerous this work is, as you said, the size of the trees. An old growth Douglas fir in the Pacific Northwest can be a couple hundred feet tall, and it can weigh, several tons. So when it's cut, it comes crashing to earth. It sends debris and detritus flying all over the place. Things fall out of treetops as workers are cutting trees and harvesting trees. That is the way a lot of workers are injured. But actually, when most people think of logging, they think of a guy standing there with a saw or an axe, falling a tree. But actually, in the history of the timber industry, falling a tree, getting a tree, that is to say, getting it, from standing on the ground, that has been one of the relatively lesser labor-intensive activities. The hard part of logging, and the part that has frustrated engineers and workers since people began logging, is getting a several ton timber laying on the forest floor to a place where it could be put on a railroad car or hauled by pack animals to a sawmill. That process is called yarding, again, getting it from the forest floor to a central landing. And really a lot of developments, a lot of technological developments occur in the early 20th century that are intended to make yarding quicker because, again, this is a system, an economic system and an industrial system that really values and prizes speed and efficiency. So there's a lot of new mechanical developments intended to make yarding quicker. But again, this is the story of labor history in the early 20th century. For every increase in speed and efficiency you got, it was paid for by increased risk for workers. And the big risk was they used these big engines. They were called donkey engines. They were essentially, you know, locomotive engines, locomotive steam engines that had just been repurposed to haul in logs. And so there's these really, really powerful motors, and they would connect to a fallen log via a cable, and they would drag it in. And that is where a lot of the dangers happen because, you know, logging, for the most part, takes place on steep hillsides. So they'd be dragging the logs uphill, which means, you know, at times the cables would break, logs would come tumbling downhill into crews of workers. Those cables would snap, injuring workers. As the logs are being dragged up hillsides, they release rocks. They sometimes create landslides. So yarding created all sorts of really, you know, significant dangers in the woods. Then once the timber finally got yarded and put onto usually a train and shipped to a mill, there was a whole new set of dangers. You know, the size of the saws and the speed at which employers are demanding that people in sawmills work, again, really, really increases the danger and the risk that workers have to take in order to keep their jobs. So yeah, this is an industrial system. It was extremely dangerous. Yeah, there's all these kind of anecdotes and stories I have. But, you know, I say these in the book, but there's kind of two, I think, you know, dark humor that timber workers would tell, two common timber worker jokes that would get told. One of them is a newcomer shows up to town, a sawmill town, and wonders why people, you know, no one in town has all 10 fingers. And the joke that timber workers would tell is like, oh, well, you have to sacrifice at least one finger in order to get employment. The rest of your fingers would be taken as needed. So that's one joke that was common. Another joke was common is, why does this small town have so many? Why does this small town need two cemeteries? And the joke was, one cemetery is just for the body parts of loggers. The other part is for their actual bodies when they pass away. So again, all these kind of darkly humored stories that I think speak to the fact and the ways in which danger and death and dying had become part of this industrial system.
So as historians, we study change across time, and timber work is no different. Timber work also changed over the course of the first half of the 20th century. In particular, I'm interested in what changed and how the work changed in the 1930s and 40s as timber workers need to weather the storm of these very tumultuous decades of depression and war. So can you explain a bit about how the work changed over the course of the first two decades of the century?
Yeah. So, I mean, the big thing that happens during the Depression is that timber workers come to a consensus or a realization amongst themselves that one of the things that had caused the Depression was essentially what I just described earlier, that this period of sustained cut-and-run logging or cut-out-and-get-out logging, where employers are simply trying to harvest as much timber as quickly as possible without any concern for the ecology or any concern for the long-term economic and social health of the very communities that they had built in order to facilitate really kind of, you know, expansive and expanded logging. So the big change that happened in the '30s is, you know, loggers start seeing these cutover lands that are increasingly being abandoned by companies going under. They start to see that this system is not sustainable whatsoever. And they really start putting a lot of pressure on both federal and state governments to institute new laws that are going to make the timber industry both more socially and economically and environmentally sustainable. Now, one of the things I detail in the book is that for a host of reasons, a lot of them having to do with kind of the politics of the New Deal state, some of them having to do with the ways these companies were structured, a lot of those, the federal government really doesn't intervene, at least in the 1930s and 40s, as, you know, a check against the growing power of timber companies. So workers kind of realized that, you know, if anything is going to be done to really reform this industry, make it safer, make it sustainable, both economically, socially, and environmentally, then this is something they're going to have to do, you know, for themselves. So that really spurs the creation of a really, really powerful labor movement in the Pacific Northwest timber industry. Now, again, there had been antecedents, there had been fits and starts of unionism before. But, you know, what I argue in the book is that this desire to really protect the forest is what drives a lot of workers into organized labor, or puts, you know, encourages them to start organizing unions. And the main union I follow in the book is the IWA, the International Woodworkers of America. And one of the things I say in the book is, you know, there was much an environmental movement as there were a labor movement, that they really saw protecting the forest as inseparable from protecting, you know, workers. And they argued that in order to have a strong union, you needed good, strong protections on logging, and vice versa. If you're going to have healthy forests, you need a strong union. So this is really what they emerged. So, I mean, in terms of the way that changes the work, over time, the IWA, especially in World War II, is going to force companies to adopt a lot more safety measures that, you know, the work is always dangerous. The work remains dangerous to this day. You know, logging is still one of the most deadly occupations, but it becomes less dangerous because of pressure placed on the by employers, by the IWA. The IWA also, you know, and again, this is a big chunk of the book, really puts pressure on employers and the federal government and various, you know, agencies to make timber harvesting more sustainable and make sure that there are jobs in perpetuity as well as forests in perpetuity. And I said World War II becomes really important in the history of the IWA, and it's a point where they can leverage a lot of power. And that has everything to do with wartime demand for lumber. You know, historians who study World War II have talked a lot about the importance of aluminum in World War II, rightfully so, right? Aluminum is central to a lot of the technologies that were important in World War II, mostly airplanes and ships. But the U.S. military still needed a lot of good old-fashioned lumber to fight the war. They also needed a lot of new housing for wartime workers as well as military personnel, and so that came from the Pacific Northwest Forest. So the IWA is able to essentially use the nation's demand for lumber and say, all right, here is our time to really grow. We are at the peak of our power, and we're going to use that to press for both safer conditions, union recognition, and eventually a more sustainable, sound system of rules and regulations to protect the forests.
I want to return to the topic of environmentalism that we started off with, since the post-war era is it's this period, you know, the 1950s and especially 1960s and early 70s brings about this raft of all kinds of new environmental regulations that are going to have all sorts of really important implications for the timber industry and for timber workers themselves. Yeah, an interesting argument that you make in the book is that you say that some laws like the 1964 Wilderness Act that in the Northwest are kind of just continuations of pre-existing trends. So can you talk about this moment of post-war environmentalism and how it's playing out in timber country in the context that you're examining here?
Yeah, absolutely. So, right, one of the things, so well before the 1964 Wilderness Act, expanding wilderness had been a, you know, cause and concern of a kind of new emerging core of activists. They weren't necessarily called environmentalists at this point. They were kind of wilderness advocates or conservationists or preservationists, depending on where they kind of fell on the political spectrum of American environmental politics. And expanding wilderness had also been a major concern of the IWA. And what the IWA believed and what it argued was that if you have expanded wilderness areas, that is to say areas where no harvests, no sorts of industrial activity are allowed whatsoever, that will remove that timber essentially from the marketplace. And that will force employers to manage the stands that they do have access to more sustainably. Essentially, what they want to do is limit the timber supply, and that will force employers to really take a lot more caution with the timber that they do have access to. And so the IWA really begins making that argument in the 1930s. And the IWA is founded in 1937. And immediately after they're founded, they start weighing in on the debate around the creation of Olympic National Park. Really important beautiful national park in Washington State on the Olympic Peninsula. And when they intervened in that whole debate, and the Olympic Peninsula or the Olympic National Park was a debate because timber companies wanted access to the timber and preservationists did not want them to have access to the timber. And the IWA intervenes saying, no, we want this national park. A, because, you know, they too, like many of those preservationists, were moved by the beauty of this place, but they also believe that, like, hey, we don't allow any cutting in this national park. That's going to force all the other timber operators in that part of Washington to really, you know, be a lot more cautious with the stands they do have access to. So this had been one of the kind of driving, you know, political or environmental political causes of the IWA since its founding. And especially after World War II, there is a massive increase in timber harvest. This has everything to do with, you know, the post-war housing boom and the creation of suburbs. All that was built with Northwest lumber, or a lot of it was built with Northwest lumber. So there's new demands being placed on Forest Service land, on private lands, and the IWA starts to say, you know, starts actually joining with a lot of these wilderness advocates saying, hey, if we keep going the direction we're going, we are going to, you know, not have any sort of protected spaces left whatsoever. And so there's a whole bunch of debates that happened with some Northwest forest land. And at that time, before the 1964 Wilderness Act, the Forest Service more or less had complete control over determining where wilderness areas were and weren't. It wasn't really a democratic process. And the IWA, along with wilderness advocates, say, hey, we need a more democratic process here. This was the kind of the promise of the New Deal. This was the promise of kind of post-war conservation, that, you know, resources and how to allocate and use resources would be subject to, you know, the people's wills and the people's wants, not a bureaucratic agency and certainly not a private company. So over the course of these debates and fights over specific wilderness areas in the post-war era, many of which the IWA and wilderness advocates lose, they increasingly put pressure on the federal government to create a more democratic system whereby wilderness would be decided by elected representatives, not necessarily bureaucrats in the Forest Service. And the result of that is the 1964 Wilderness Act. So when I say the 1964 Wilderness Act was connected to previous ideas, what I'm saying, it's connected to this previous idea of the IWA being very in support of wilderness because they believe that this is kind of the path forward in terms of managing stands, all stands more, you know, equitably. And it's also connected to this idea of more democratic land management that is really a cornerstone of New Deal land use policy.
The 1970s bring about some more changes, though. And
oh, do they ever? Yeah.
do they ever? Right. Yeah. And especially for a book like this that is, you know, so much about workers and is about the power of labor, you know, the 70s see this real sort of chipping away, this decline in the power of organized labor as economic changes are altering the political landscape, even within, you know, relatively remote places like the Pacific Northwest in timber country. So, as cities like Seattle and like Portland and like Vancouver begin to grow and change, how is that also affecting these kind of forested hinterlands? How are timber workers reacting to these changes? I guess to put it really, really kind of shortly and bluntly, in an industry that's already under duress in this era, how is it that the arrival of aging hippies causes something of like a crisis in the Northwest?
Yeah. So this was, I don't want to say it's my favorite part of the book because it is a, it's a sad story as far as I'm concerned, but it was the part of the book that, again, I don't want to say I enjoyed writing it, but it helped me understand the Northwest that I currently live in the best, working on this part of the book. So in that sense, I really enjoyed it. But yeah, so what happens in the 1970s is, you know, from 1880s until the 1970s, the Northwest's economy had been rooted in resource extraction. Like, yeah, you had some manufacturing, you know, you had, of course, Boeing in Seattle. You had shipbuilding in Portland and Seattle. But still, you know, the Northwest is a resource extraction economy. This starts to shift after World War II, but it dramatically shifts after 1970. And the, you know, a host of reasons why it shifts, having to do with new environmental laws and regulations, both politicians in Washington and Oregon looking for ways to incentivize industrial production over resource extraction. But what happens is As the economy pivots away from resource extraction, politicians and people, for the most part, in Pacific Northwest really start to view logging as the relic of a bygone era, not part of the future, but part of the past. Now, in actual point of fact, there's still a lot of timber being harvested, and timber remains an important part of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho's GDP well into the late 20th century. But the public perception is there was a time when logging belonged here, no more. At the same time, voters in Washington and Oregon especially are starting to elect anti-growth, kind of more environmentalist-oriented politicians. The famous example in Oregon is Tom McCall, who is this, you know, really anti-growth, pro-environment governor who spearheaded a bunch of new initiatives to protect the environment in Oregon. But that is kind of the way of the future. And, you know, a lot of people believe that the future of Oregon is going to be manufacturing, potentially high-tech manufacturing in urban areas. And they don't have to worry so much about what's going on in rural areas, particularly, you know, logging areas. And again, in the 1970s, for a host of reasons, just like most of the industrial economy, the timber industry is struggling. So what happens in the 1970s is kind of the origins of an urban-rural divide. And again, anyone who is familiar with the politics of the West, specifically the Pacific Northwest, will understand exactly what I'm talking about. Kind of cultural, political, social division that happens among urban communities and rural communities. Because, you know, urban communities are saying, hey, we don't need logging. Forests are better left untouched. They're better left for recreation and wildlife habitat. We don't need timber. And people in rural communities who are struggling are saying, hey, we actually need jobs. Our livelihood and our way of lives are rapidly disappearing. And so this creates a kind of new, you know, like I said, new urban-rural divide. And the other thing that happens then that puts a lot of tension on this whole system is, right, you get a new influx of migrants to many areas of rural Oregon. Because the timber economy was struggling, what happened was land values essentially collapsed in much of rural Oregon, which meant that, you know, middle-class professionals or, you know, old hippies could essentially afford places in rural communities and buy nice homes. And, you know, the thing about the rural Northwest in the 70s is it was economically struggling, but it was still a very beautiful place to live. And, you know, a lot of people who could now afford homes in this area, they said, hey, I'm going to move out to the country and, you know, live a life of leisure. And so when these new people are moving into these rural communities, they don't want to see clear cuts and they don't want to see logging trucks. They moved out to these, you know, forested areas because they wanted hiking trails and they wanted to see deer and elk running around in the woods. So there's a lot of pressure and a lot of critiques of logging that come from this influx of migrants that come to the rural Northwest, which really makes a lot of timber workers and people who had been living in some of these communities for generations feel that they're kind of strangers in their own home. And so that puts a lot of new pressure on, you know, the internal dynamics of a lot of rural communities.
Well, as we begin to wrap up here, let's bring this story up to the present day. You know, we live in a moment today where environmental concerns are very much first and foremost in our politics. Climate change and other crises as well are, you know, growing more and more at the center of our culture and our politics. So how have the timber industry and timber workers continued to adapt? What's the story after this moment of change in the Northwest? And where does the story stand today?
Yeah, great question. And yeah, one of the things I was really adamant about doing in this book was bringing the story right up to the present. One of my frustrations is, you know, a lot has been written about the timber industry. And generally speaking, most, at least historical treatments, end in the era of the spotted owl. So again, just real briefly, a lot more of this detail in my book. And if anyone wants to read more, there are lots of things you could read about the spotted owl conflict. But in the late 80s, early 90s, environmentalists start putting pressure on Congress and land management agencies to essentially shut down logging in order to protect the spotted owl, which was an endangered species. And as you might imagine, it's a very complicated story, but the long and short of it is that by the mid-1990s, the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, as well as state and the federal government had kind of sided with environmentalists and said, we are going to put very significant restrictions on logging, which has a huge economic impact on the timber industry, and harvest rates in both Oregon and Washington collapse after the Spotted Owl conflict. So most historians end the story there, and it is a perfectly logical place to end the story. But I talked with so many timber workers who said, there's still more to the story. Like, we are still around. We are still an important part of life in the Pacific Northwest. Someone imploring me, like, don't end the story with the Spotted Owl. There's more here. So I was really adamant about taking the story up to the present, which I do in the book. So one of the things I argue is that, you know, after the Spotted Owl, there was a lot of economic and social problems created by the collapse of the timber industry. But people in timber country have done what they've always done. They weathered this storm and they found ways to remain, you know, keep their livelihoods and keep their connection to the forest by relying on the timber industry and relying on the forest. So one of the big things that's happened is a lot of the big kind of multinational companies have disinvested from the region, both during and after the era of the Spotted Owl conflict, which kind of opened up new space for smaller producers. And these smaller producers, unlike the big companies, which were viewing the Northwest as a vast resource extraction colony, they take a more long-term and, you know, more local view of land management, which is to say they don't want to just cut everything over. They actually want to manage, you know, trees for both the livelihoods of these rural communities as well as the ecological health of the forest. So there's been a new emphasis on more sustainable management, on replanting, on doing all sorts of, you know, or making all sorts of management decisions that are going to essentially preserve everything that workers have been advocating for since the 1930s, which is recreational spaces, healthy ecosystems, and a functioning timber industry. So climate change has, especially in Oregon, though, been a kind of complicated factor, or at least recent politics have really kind of, the recent politics around climate change have complicated the ways in which timber folks in the timber industry have been able to kind of go about getting their political goals realized. And that's because several years ago, and I detail all this in the book, the Oregon legislature proposed a bill that would have imposed significant taxes on fuel in order to essentially create money or create funds for addressing climate change, as well as to kind of tax, you know, fuel to disincentivize the use of fuel. And what people in the timber industry argued was that this was going to impact them significantly. So a new kind of movement, it was called Timber Unity, emerged several years ago, really putting a lot of pressure on the state legislature to not enact this law because they said they'd be unfairly penalized. And it created a lot of divisive politics in the Pacific Northwest. It created a lot of, you know, acrimony and rancor, just because, you know, the dividing lines that are detailed in the book between the urban and rural Northwest kind of reemerged in a really significant way of, you know, rural people tending to support the timber unity movement, urban people tending to support climate change legislation. So it has been something that is kind of part of the new debate. But what I argue in the book is that, you know, timber unity is not perfect. They definitely have their problems in terms of kind of some of their political beliefs. But one of the things is, if you sit down and talk to these folks, and again, I was able to interview some of them, what you realize is that they care deeply about the forest the same way earlier generations of timber workers did. They might not share that early generation's politics, but they have that same concern and care for the forest. And what many of them believe, and I believe that there is some forestry research to back this up, is that one of the best ways to address climate change is not by finding ways to penalize or put economic, you know, controls on the timber industry, but actually facilitating the timber industry. Because what these timber workers argue is that if you, you know, a tree grows throughout its lifetime, but it doesn't grow uniformly throughout its lifetime. A tree grows quicker in its first 10, 15, 20 years of existence than it does much later in its life. So what people in the industry argue is that by managing forests on a 50-year harvest rotation, that is to say, you let trees grow 50 years, cut them down, and replant them, that will actually capture more carbon from the atmosphere than just taking a hands-off approach. And they also say there's other reasons not to take this hands-off approach. You know, you start not allowing for active management of forests or logging, and that creates an excess of fuels in the forest, which leads to forest fires. Forest fires are being driven by climate change, but also a contributor to climate change because they release a lot of carbon in the atmosphere. So timberwalkers say, like, hey, we actually care about the climate and we care about climate change. And I know, again, some of these folks I talked to, I wasn't fully expecting them to say, like, oh, climate change, that's a liberal hoax. Almost all of them I talked to said, no, climate change is real. We have to do something about it. And one of the best things we can do, at least here in Oregon, is allow for more logging, sustainable, you know, very carefully monitored logging, but allow for logging, allow for a system of replanting that allows the system of more carbon capture through timber growth. Now, again, I want to be very clear that there's some forestry research that supports that. There's some research that doesn't support that. But where I kind of end the book, and what I say in the book is, you know, the fact that these folks really aren't being listened to, and that the conversation around this climate change legislation is being driven predominantly by environmentalists and politicians representing urban communities is part of the problem, is that there needs to be more communication between, you know, the urban and rural communities in the Northwest, between environmentalists and workers. And I think what history shows is that when these divides didn't exist, or when the divides between environmentalists and workers weren't so divisive, a lot of great things got done for the environment. And so that's really what the book is imploring people to do, is, you know, you don't have to agree with everything timberwalkers say, but listen to them. They spend their life in the woods. They don't just work there. I still get to meet a timberworker who doesn't hunt or fish. You know, these forests are important to them for so many reasons, and they are the last people on earth who want to see these places disappear. And, you know, because they spend their lives in the forest and they care about the forest so deeply and they use the forest in so many ways, we should at least be listening to them and making them part of the conversation. They deserve a place at the table when it comes to management decisions.
You know, for one of my last questions, I always like to ask my guests, what is one point or one idea that you hope readers come away from this book understanding? It sounds like you articulated just that, actually.
That is the main one. And again, timberworkers, I don't agree with everything timberworkers always say. And, you know, but that, it's not the point. It's that they have to be part of the conversation. And, you know, you asked earlier that question about, you know, changes in the 1970s. And that was one of the big political consequences of the 1970s, is people from timberworking communities became socially and politically isolated. Now, that also had as much to do with the collapse of organized labor as well, right? The union had given them power, not just on the job site, but in the Northwest political system. And as unions disappeared, so did workers' voices. And the timber unity movement, which is kind of actually last year or two, there's been some like disruptions within that movement. So timber unity doesn't actually exist. It kind of got rebranded as a new organization. Regardless, you know, they're kind of imperfect messengers, just because a lot of their rallies were loud and raucous. Several times they shut down the state capitol in Salem with these huge rallies. So again, they're imperfect messengers, and I don't want to defend everything they do or every belief they have, but I do think they're worth listening to. I think people from rural timber working communities are worth listening to. And again, it goes back to kind of where I started, was, you know, think about how much timber surrounds you, your furniture, your house, your books, what have you. We need timber to function as a modern society. So let's make sure that the people who are harvesting that timber and getting us the lumber for our houses and the pulp for our books, let's make sure that they are part of the conversation, because, you know, A, they deserve to be part of the conversation just for an issue of pure equity. But they also deserve to be part of the conversation because they have some good ideas about how we could and should manage timber in ways that benefit us all, not just the timber industry, not just environmentalists.
So I'm realizing, before I ask my final question, that I never asked you about the title of this book.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a very striking title. In fact, I think that was when I was looking for new people to bring on the show. I think the title stood out to me first, and I thought to myself, what is this book all about? What are Strong Winds and Widowmakers? What are we talking about here? So real quick, before we wrap up, where does this title come from?
Good. Well, thank you for asking that. And I'm glad that the title had the intended effect, right? Which is to encourage people to pick up the book. Okay. So The actual title, Strong Winds and Widowmakers, it comes from a song by Buzz Martin. So one of the arguments I make in the book is that in the 1970s, part of what created this new urban-rural divide was people in urban communities and people in rural communities started kind of like paying attention to different culture. And I borrow from a lot of other labor historians who have looked at kind of the cultural changes that happened among the white working class in the 1970s. One of the things that so many historians have talked about is, you know, country music, and specifically like this outlaw variant of country music, become, you know, think Merle Haggard, think Charlie Daniels, it becomes essentially the soundtrack for the white working class backlash of the 1960s and 1970s. So I was very influenced by those arguments. And, you know, during the course of this research, I came across this guy whose name was Buzz Martin. And I kind of described Buzz Martin as the Merle Haggard of Northwest timber country. He is from Oregon. You know, he never made it huge, even though like Johnny Cash was a fan of his and several other kind of big, well-known country musicians were fans of his. He never made it huge. He was not really a commercial success, but he had a big following among timber workers. And one of the reasons he had this following among timber workers was because, like I say, he's the Merle Haggard of timber country. He is giving voice to their frustrations and their angers of how the Northwest is changing and kind of leaving them behind. And one of his songs is called Strong Winds and Widowmakers. And I always like the title because I think it spoke to, well, I like that title for his song, but also for the book. So I think it speaks to many different things. First of all, is like this issue of danger, right? Strong winds, dangerous. A widowmaker is essentially a branch that gets caught in the canopy of a tree and it'll fall down as workers are working, hit them on the head. And it was, you know, part of the Lugger's Luck scan was called the Widowmakers. Strong Winds and Widowmakers. It had this kind of sense of foreboding, the sense of like, you know, by picking up this book, you're entering a world of danger and risk and things like that. But also a lot of Buzz Martin's book, or excuse me, a lot of Buzz Martin's music, and the song Strong Winds and Widowmakers specifically is about pride and the pride that loggers took in the job of doing a really difficult job and doing it well, the pride that they took in being stewards of the forest and caring for these forests at the same time that they worked in them, the pride that they took in supplying the lumber that environmentalists in cities who critiqued them nevertheless relied on. And so I also like that because, you know, one of the things I think this book about is about, you know, among many other things, is pride and the pride that people from these communities have for their work, their communities, their forests. So like I said, I think the name, I borrowed it from Buzz Martin, but it speaks to all these different themes that I wanted to speak to in the book.
And then for my last question, I always like to get an idea or a sense or a preview from my guests mm-hmm. of what it is that they're working on next. I know this book has not been out for very long, but do you have a second project in the oven at all? Something you've been working on?
Yeah, well, I got more ideas than time I'll ever have to complete them.
Of course.
So, I mean, it depends on which day you ask me on what I'm most excited about. But I got two projects. I kind of go back and forth. You know, I just got to, at some point, commit to one and finish that one, then go back to the next one. But the first one is I want to do a history of small timber landowners in Oregon. And maybe even take a micro-historical approach. I have to figure it out. But, you know, there's a lot of writing on the big timber companies. But what we know less about and what there's very little historical research on is small timberland companies. And the reason I think not small timberland, small timber owners. And one of the reasons I think small timber owners are interesting is because unlike the big companies, they have long had a vested interest in long-term sustainability of managing their lands. So again, they oftentimes depend on a certain number of harvests in order to make their, you know, livelihoods, but they can't just cut it all down because then they will be out of money and their land will be cut over. So, you know, what I think in many small forest land owners I've spoken with and even toured some of their properties is if we understand how these folks manage their land, that might help us better understand how to manage larger chunks of land like the Forest Service or the BLM or things like that. So I think if we paid more attention to small timberland owners, that might unlock some ways of thinking about how we manage forests more broadly. So that's project number one. Project number two is that in 1940, a woman in Aberdeen named Laura Law was murdered, and it was a gruesome, vicious murder. And Laura Law was a member of the IWA Women's Auxiliary. She was also a member of the Communist Party. Her husband, Dick Law, was also a member of the Communist Party and also a really, really important activist in the IWA. And the case is still unsolved. But I kind of thought a history of that would be really interesting. Like a lot of people, I'm into true crime, so this would be allow me to dabble in true crime. But it also, I think, speaks to larger themes and issues of radicalism and how radicalism is debated, how radicalism has been a part of the Pacific Northwest's political landscape, and why, the challenges that radicals faced, especially in the 1940s. So, like I said, it depends what day you ask me. I have a couple other projects I might be toying with, but right now, those are the two that are in the lead.
Well, those both sound like fantastic projects, and they're both American West projects, so whenever you get around to finishing one, I'll have you back on the show. How's that sound?
It would be an absolute pleasure.
Dr. Stephen Bina is an associate professor of history at the University of Oregon, and his new book is Strong Winds and Widowmakers, Workers, Nature, and Environmental Conflict in Pacific Northwest Timber Country, which came out just last year in 2023 with the University of Illinois Press. Thank you so much for joining me today, Steve.
Well, thank you for having me. It was wonderful.